Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hi, Brian Lehrer here. Up next, Brian Lehrer Weekend. Three of our favorite segments from the week packaged together for you to listen to on the weekend. So enjoy, and I'll see you back on the radio Monday at 10 a.m. on WNYC and WNYC.org. WNYC. So, what'd you do this weekend? Did you catch up on sleep? Do the laundry or other errands and chores? Did you manage to see friends and spend time with your family? With only 2 days off from work a week, it can be impossible to get everything done, and more often than not, we have to abandon some plans and promises just to make the most urgent things fit. Well, now imagine you had one extra day off per week. What else could you do? Would you feel more rested, less resentful? Would you be able to work on a passion project or take the kids on a trip? The concept of a three-day weekend has been floating around the American business consciousness for some time, but has never really taken hold. People worry about lost wages, lost productivity, and fewer dollars in the economy overall. Well, now at least there's some data to support that the opposite might be true. Did you hear about this? Iceland just released results of a 4-year study of more than 2,500 employees in different fields whose work weeks were reduced by 1 day and found an increased sense of well-being among workers with no loss of productivity. In fact, in some places, workers were more productive after cutting back their hours. So what would it take to try it here? And has the pandemic and all that working from home nudged us further in one direction or another? With me now to talk about this is a writer who has made a name for herself talking about work burnout and has written explicitly recently about the idea of the 4-day week. It's Anne Helen Peterson, culture writer and co-author of a forthcoming book called Out of Office, The Big Problem and Bigger Promise of Working from Home. Hi, Anne. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hi, I'm so glad to be here.
And let's start by stating the obvious, which is that not everyone works full time. Not everyone works 5 days a week. Some people work part time or freelance or work more than 5 days a week. Do you have a sense of approximately how many Americans work the stereotypical 40-hour or 5-day work week?
You know, I think it's really, really hard to gauge because, you know, there's a lot of people who are wage workers, right, who do clock in and clock out, but then might also be working second jobs or be working side hustles that are more difficult to quantify. And people who are salaried, who maybe ostensibly work a 40-hour week, anyone who worked from home during the pandemic will tell you that they worked far more than 40 hours a week. And there's also just a lot of slippage these days in terms of how, when work is expected to be completed in after hours times. So I think that any data that, like, you know, the Department of Labor Services has, like, it's still not necessarily a great accounting for how much work we're doing. And then also just thinking about, you know, if we say I work 40 hours a week, how much of those 40 hours are you actually working? And how much, especially for people who do knowledge work or work on computers, like, how much are you just kind of fiddling around on your computer and how much you're actually working?
Yeah. And you wrote that there's nothing natural about the length of our work week. It has been and should continue to be malleable to the needs and health of workers, which is to say to the needs and health of society at large. That's a quote from you. So maybe people who haven't thought about this might like to hear you talk a little bit of the origin of the weekend as we know it.
Yeah, so this is the work of labor advocates over the course of the, you know, the 19th century, the mid-20th century. There was this push with the expansion of electricity to really expand the workday to any time that, you know, people could be in factories, right, could have illumination that would allow them to do work. And then over the course of the 1800s and 1900s, various guilds and labor organizations really pushed back against that to form what we now know as the 5-day work week. And I think, you know, and another significant moment in that was Henry Ford allowing all of his workers a 5-day work week, which was the sort of like seismic shift that also opened it up to lots of other different types of workers. But the point is, too, even before that, before electricity, lots of work was seasonal. There was different types of jobs that you just couldn't do for different seasons, right? Because it demanded that you be outside or that you have longer hours of illumination. Like, work has expanded and contracted, and the great promise of automation that we are going through right now, right? Computers can do so much more work for us, is that we should be able to work less, right? Not we should be working the same as we ever have before.
So listeners, you can get in on this. How would your life be different if you could take an extra day off a week, even if you work more hours per day for the 4 days to make it possible? But as you hear, our guest Ann Helen Peterson is also talking about just working fewer hours. 646-435-7280. What would you be able to get done in 3 days off that is impossible in two? And we also want to hear from bosses, from managers. Could you make a 4-day week work in your office or business? What would the challenges be? And what worries you about the concept if you are worried listening to this? 646-435-7280, 646-435-7280, from any of those perspectives or others, as we continue with Ann Helen Peterson, culture writer and co-author of the forthcoming book, Out of Office: The Big Problem and Bigger Promise of Working from Home. 646-435-7280, or tweet at Brian Lehrer. Okay, so this new study comes out of Iceland. How did this experiment come to be, and what did it really reveal?
So this Iceland experiment is really, really interesting because the other experiments that have happened over the course of the last 5-10 years have really been limited to people, just individual corporations, right? And the fact that they're performed at individual corporations allows other corporations to be like, well, that worked for them, but it would never work for us. And so the difference with what happened with Iceland is they looked at similar countries, right? Other Nordic countries that have similar safety nets, similar ideas about, parental leave, all these different things, but saw that in Iceland, people were working much longer hours and were much more miserable at work, just looking at general survey questions about fatigue and feeling like they have time for friends or family, that sort of thing. And so they thought, okay, if we have the same productivity level, the same GDP, like, why are our people working so much more? What if we tried encouraging them through a reduced work week to do better work, more concentrated work when they're at work, and then create more space for leisure and time for rest in the rest of their week? And they started small with, you know, mayor's office, like other federal agencies. The first organization that they partnered with was actually a group that works with their form of foster care and child protective services, because those professions, as in the United States, are professions with incredibly high rates of burnout and stress. So they wanted to figure out, how can we decrease some of that burnout and stress by actually decreasing the number of hours these people work? And it slowly expanded over the course of the next few years, and also importantly expanded to people not just doing office work, but also people doing construction, people doing maintenance, people working front desks. And each organization within the study had to really figure out, okay, how are we going to make this work for us? Because it really is different, profession by profession, job by job, office by office, how you can reduce hours but still have the same levels of service. And the results are just, they're very clear. Productivity is up, happiness is up, you know, absenteeism is down. Basically, people are better workers when they are working less. But the services, the quality of service remains the same.
Let's take a phone call from, I think, somebody who's doing this. Cindy in Williamsburg, you're on WNYC. Hi, Cindy.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to call in. I'm one of the co-owners of Beacon's Closet, which is a buy-sell trade business that's been in Brooklyn and in Manhattan for about 24 years. We've implemented the 4-day work week for about 23 years, a full-time week at our store is between 32 and 36 hours. Retail, it's a high volume retail. People get really burned out dealing with the public. When you're stressed out, you're not nice to people. So it can be, for us, it's just always work. We've been able to pay a living wage. We provide health insurance for our employees, 100% paid. It's work for us, and it's a kinder way to run a business. It's more human, and I just wanted to say that it works.
That's really great. What trade-offs did you make in order to enable this? In other words, did you hire more people because they were each working fewer hours than at other stores, but you weren't able to pay each one as much as if they were working 40-hour weeks, or trade-offs?
I think what we did is we have a large staff, and we do have a young staff. Some of the, you know, are, so there's a lot of part-time people, but our management tends to stay with us from anywhere from 4 to 10 years. And I don't know that there is really a trade-off. I think that we do have a large part-time staff, but the people that work full-time, like I said, just don't work usually around 36 hours. And the thing is, too, it's a retail day, so we're open like 11 to 8. Mm-hmm. So the day, your 4 days might be longer hours than the standard like 9-to-5 job, but you still get that day off. So right. I just think it makes people happier.
Cindy, thank you very much. Let's take another caller. Susan in Long Beach, you're on WNYC. Hi, Susan.
Hi, so nice to talk to you. Yes, my father had a factory in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s where they made custom-made upholstery, draperies. So everyone was working in a factory, a lot of seamstresses. And the women approached my dad at one point and said, would you be willing to do a 4-day week? Because we can't get all our chores done, our errands. Back in those days, in the 60s and 70s, stores weren't necessarily open on Sundays. So he thought about it and he said, sure, let's try it. And it became the standard for his business. Everybody was happier. They got into a groove of work. So instead of leaving the factory at 4, they were still humming along till 6. Mm-hmm. And then they had a 3-day weekend, and they got a lot done, and everybody was happy.
So in that model, it is roughly the 40-hour week. It's just 4 longer
yes.
days rather than 5 shorter ones, correct?
Yes. Yes. And it gave them, I think 3 days off really gave these people a sense of, when I'm at home, I'm really at home. I'm really taking care of business at home. I'm spending time with my family, and I'm getting everything done. You can't, you really can't, anyone that runs a home knows, you can't get it all done on a Saturday
yeah.
or a Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
The shop, I mean, the stores are packed. You know, you have to go to the bank, the supermarket, the post office. All of these things, you have to do the laundry, clean the house, make all the food. It's just not possible.
And that was back when we actually made furniture in the United States. Now they make it
exactly.
all in Indonesia or
yeah,
somewhere.
Susan, Queens, New York.
Queens, New York. I've heard of it. Susan, thank you very much. So, Ann Helen Peterson, I think we heard two different models from those two callers. And I'm not sure if what you write includes the one we just heard from Susan, whose father ran a furniture factory in Queens. It's still a 40-hour week. It's not working less. It's just working longer 4 days.
Yeah, the 4-10s, that's what it's sometimes called, is you work 4 days for 10 hours, is a different model in so much as I think a lot of places, like, you know, that hasn't been a difficult argument to make. Lots of different government offices have done this, in part because if you close down the office and you don't have to pay for air conditioning on Friday, then it's actually cheaper in the long run in a lot of ways. But I do think if you talk to people who work those 4-10s, it's really exhausting. Like a 10-hour work day, especially doing anything that requires interacting with the public or really attentive work, like you are wiped after that day. And I think, you know, some companies might have to try that model to get to a different model. But I think a lot, you know, you don't see as much rejuvenation as you do with the actual reduced, you know, 32 hour model.
I thought it was really interesting, too, that the caller, Susan, said it was the women at the factory who pushed for the four-day week, and she didn't mention childcare explicitly or any family responsibilities, but we know how this tends to fall in the division of labor. I'm curious if you had any reaction or would put that in cultural context at all, hearing that anecdote.
Oh, yeah. So there are two arguments that you can make about the four-day week, and one really is directed at people who are concerned about profits. Right. And that's where you make all of these arguments about productivity and attrition, and you'll have less turnover, et cetera, et cetera. And then you make the argument to the worker and you say, you know, as this previous caller was saying, right now, for a lot of people, half of their weekend is just totally filled up with trying to manage everything from the week that got pushed to the weekend. And then maybe they have a slight moment of relaxation, depending on their lives, on Sunday. The three-day week allows you to have more time to attend to, you know, the errands of life, but it also gives you a chance, and this is what they've actually seen in companies that have tried these pilot programs. It gives people a chance to make the sort of commitments that they would otherwise not be able to make in terms of volunteering, being at their kids' schools. People who are grandparents, they can very easily be like, I will take the afternoon on Friday to take care of the kids, or I will always do pickup on Friday from school. You know, it gives those childcare opportunities that aren't always possible. So especially, you know, it doesn't have to be Friday or it doesn't have to be Monday. Some companies make it so that in order to make this work, people take the day throughout the week. Mm-hmm. So let's say you have a family and both parents work for companies that have this four-day week. One of the parents takes the day on Tuesday, the other day takes it on Thursday, or the other parent takes it on Thursday. There are 2 days of childcare that are covered.
Now, the success of the trial, this experiment in Iceland, from what I've read, has led to widespread adoption of a four-day week across that country. When the study was published earlier this month, 86% of Iceland's working population either had a reduced work week or the right to one. So, you know, a study comes out in this country and they talk about it in the media for a couple of days, but it doesn't change the power structure. Did this actually happen that way?
Well, it happened through the power of unions. And I think that's a really important thing to underline, is that unions and other advocates, but primarily unions and guilds in Iceland, were the ones who started pushing for the pilot programs. And then once the data was there, they said, okay, you know, this is something that we want to advocate for moving forward. And I think you could see various unions start to push for this in the United States as well. And in industries that aren't unionized, that's where you're going to see it, I think, a little bit more coming from CEOs and from employees. And there are companies that are really eager to do this.
Yeah. And You write that you were struck by the word that the authors of the report from Iceland used to describe participant shift in work-life balance. They felt they were achieving something close to harmony. But already in Iceland and in Scandinavia, these international surveys of happiness always tend to come out a lot higher in places like that than in this country. So I'm just curious what struck you about the word harmony in this context.
Well, I think harmony is just a much better word than work-life balance, because I think now that phrase has really been hollowed out. When a company starts talking about the importance of work-life balance, it's usually because they're inviting you to have none of it in order to distinguish yourself. And so I think something like harmony tries to get at this idea that you are a better person at work, right? And that makes you a better person in your non-work life, and vice versa. They have really a symbiotic effect on one another. And I think right now we do have a symbiotic effect, but it's an unharmonic, a dissonant effect, in that the amount that we work makes us worse people in our non-work lives, right?
One more call. Gail in Central Jersey, you're on WNYC. Hi, Gail.
Hi. I come from the point of view of healthcare. And, you know, healthcare in New Jersey covers a third of our working population. But healthcare in many cases are 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And we, you know, spend years without realizing what a weekend is, because our weekends are sometimes during the middle of the week. Plus, what do you do when the workload doesn't go down and someone has to be physically present to do it if you can't do
it? Gail, thank you so much. And briefly, Anne, because we're going to run out of time shortly, does this apply beyond sort of what you called at the beginning knowledge workers?
Yeah, for sure. And I, you know, in Iceland and in other countries that make this work, they have people working those shifts, right? It's not about not having people work 9 to 5. It's about staggering those shifts, but then people still have a less than 40-hour work week, and they are more attentive medical professionals because of it.
Right. And in our last minute, does the pandemic affect the conversation in this country on this already? Does it actually affect it, or is it just media chatter?
Well, I do think that people are reconsidering the placement of work in their lives and also priorities in their lives. And the other thing is that I think that it's an employee market right now when it comes to hiring. Employees have some power, both in retail jobs and also in knowledge jobs that they have not had before. So this is one way to make yourself an attractive employer.
And they have more power. Why? I mean, we just had like 20% unemployment in this country a year ago because of the pandemic. How did the employees, and we just really literally have 15 seconds for this answer, but how did employees wind up with more power?
Well, they had the ability to say no. And part of that was unemployment insurance. And part of that is people who were knowledge workers and had accumulated some form of savings can now say, I want to work for a different sort of company. I want to have a different approach to work.
Anne Helen Peterson, her forthcoming book, Out of Office, The Big Problem and Bigger Promise of Working from Home. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
WNYC, if you go out partying with drugs, you may have heard from a friend or a friend of a friend that there is a fentanyl in cocaine problem and to be careful. That's right. Fentanyl, the synthetic opiate that's been creeping into heroin over the past few years because it's cheaper and more addictive and it causes the majority of overdose deaths, we're told, is now showing up in other street drugs and has the potential to cause more accidental overdoses, especially because people using stimulants like cocaine might not think to carry Narcan. With me now to talk about this is Caroline Lewis, a freelance journalist who frequently contributes to Gothamist and WNYC, who's been reporting on this topic. Hi, Caroline. Welcome back to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me. Good to be back.
Why would fentanyl be in cocaine? They have the opposite effect, right? One's a powerful opiate. The other is a stimulant.
Yeah, that's a good question. And the answer is we are not totally sure at this point. As you mentioned, it frequently shows up in heroin, and it's intentionally cut into heroin or even sold in lieu of heroin. So there is the possibility that it's sort of accidentally making its way into cocaine in certain situations. You know, if someone's mixing white powders, they might accidentally mix it in. And even a trace amount of fentanyl could have, a big impact on someone who has no tolerance for opioids because they don't regularly do opioids. But then, it might be possible that dealers are sometimes putting it in on purpose. You know, again, it's cheap to make and highly addictive. And maybe once it starts showing up, someone's like, oh, I actually like that. You know, I think at this point, we need to do more research where we're actually interviewing people about this.
And to the question of how big a problem this is, right now, in April, I see you received data from the NYPD that indicated 8% of the city's cocaine supply now contains fentanyl. That would be about one out of every 12 bags sold on the street, which is a lot. And I think you expressed some hesitancy with this data. So can you talk it out for us?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm glad you brought that up. I think it's important to acknowledge that we actually don't know how prevalent fentanyl is in the cocaine supply right now, and obviously it can fluctuate. And when I first started reporting this story, I was very alarmed because the city health department, said that NYPD drug testing from April, their data from April showed that 8% of the cocaine they tested from their drug seizures contained fentanyl. But I've since learned that it's possible that April was an outlier. And I'm still working to get more data from the NYPD for the months leading up to that and after that to sort of put it in context. And I would say based on additional research that I've done, I would speculate that, you know, if we look at it on an annual basis, the share of cocaine laced with fentanyl is likely less than 8%. But that said, even if in April, you know, it was an outlier, I think it shows that you never know when a bad batch might be going around. And I think in general, it would be great if we did more drug testing and were able to get data from sources other than law enforcement.
So listeners, have you or has anyone you know been affected by this summer's apparent increase in fentanyl-laced cocaine overdoses? Call us and help us report this story at 646-435-7280. Maybe if you're a cocaine user, you sought out Narcan, the anti-overdose antidote for the first time, or fentanyl testing strips. What was that experience like? Or do you work in healthcare, substance abuse treatment, and or harm reduction? Have you been seeing more patients, if you do that kind of work, who've overdosed on synthetic opioids in the past weeks or months or years? We also want to hear from you if you work in nightlife. Do you have Narcan on your premises, or have you trained your staff on how to spot an overdose, and have you had to put that training into practice? 646-435 for those questions or anything else, 646-435-7280, or tweet at Brian Lehrer with Caroline Lewis, health journalist who contributes frequently to Gothamist and WNYC. And also with us now is Ceci Kuwabara Blanchard, who is a harm reduction outreach worker at a New York City syringe exchange program and director of the Democratic Socialist of America's Opioid Overdose Prevention Program, also a freelance journalist. Ceci, thank you for coming on with us. Hi.
Hi, Brian. It's great to be with you.
Let me ask you about a particular incident. I see that you say you helped reverse a coke fentanyl overdose at a Bushwick rave in June. Can you tell us about that experience, and was it the first time you had witnessed the effect of cocaine laced with fentanyl?
So it actually was, and I think that might speak to the rarity at this point of these overdoses, or at least like the confirmed situation of cocaine mixed with fentanyl. It was at the end of May. I was walking out of the rave, actually, and then a huge crowd had formed. Someone was falling out. That's kind of like the colloquial phrase for overdosing. And I happen to have, I always carry two Narcan doses in my purse with me. And that's really important, too, for listeners to know, is that one of the doses of Narcan usually isn't enough, especially when fentanyl is involved. So it's always really important to bring multiple doses with you. So then, you know, I whipped it out, and I actually had to pass it off to someone who then administered it. But it was kind of like a tag team situation. But again, I think I do want to emphasize that this is a very rare occurrence, or at least in term as far as confirmed cases go. And I think it is worth emphasizing, and I know Caroline has mentioned this, but there's only been two, you know, reported cases, or at least this kind of trending story right now is only based off of two rumored stories. And as far as I know, none of them have actually been confirmed to involve either, or they, neither of the deaths have actually been attributed directly to those substances. So I do think we need to be careful when we're talking about this as a trend. And I think also the seizure data, and as Caroline said, that April may have been an outlier. I do think we need to be a bit careful when we're talking about this issue.
Ceci, from your knowledge base as a harm reduction outreach worker, might someone who's expecting a stimulant and receives a powerful opioid instead or in addition without expecting it be more vulnerable to overdose? As far as you know, and if so, why would it work that way?
Absolutely. So I mean, first off, when you're using a stimulant, you just aren't expecting usually, unless, you know, you're mixing it intentionally, which is a speedball in the case of cocaine and an opioid, and then a goofball as far as methamphetamine and an opioid goes. But so there's the first element that you're just simply not expecting it. And, you know, the effects are quite different. But also on a physiological level, the stimulant, either, you know, in this case, cocaine, but also methamphetamine, makes your body work harder. And so then you need to breathe more. You need more oxygen. And then at the same time, the opioid, and in this case, you know, fentanyl, which is very potent, far more potent than heroin, is suppressing your ability to breathe and get that oxygen. And so then that's how, that cocktail can prove more fatal than otherwise.
Caroline, did you want to add something there?
This was actually just in response to how big of an issue this trend is. I agree that, you know, recent anecdotal reports mostly have not been confirmed. Like, I had submitted, you know, a name of someone I heard overdosed from suspected, you know, mixture of cocaine and fentanyl to the medical examiner and haven't heard back yet. But in terms of data, like, there is data showing that overdose deaths involving cocaine and synthetic opioids have been going up in recent years, both in New York and nationally. And I think it's still somewhat unclear how much of that is the result of people intentionally doing multiple drugs, either, you know, at the same time or separately, and how much of it is unsuspecting cocaine users getting psyched drugs. But there is evidence that that happens. You know, like, there have been clusters of, there have been incidents where, several people will go to the ER within a few hours in a small geographic area, including one incident in New York City in 2019 with, you know, fentanyl overdoses, and say they just did cocaine. So I think there's evidence that it happens. And the question is just really how often.
Aliyah in Newark, you're on WNYC. Hello, Aliyah. Thank you for calling in.
Hello.
Hi there. We gotcha.
Hey, so I was calling. I was saying that I hear that a lot of emphasis is being placed on how there's fentanyl and opioids and people in nightlife and things like that. But I'm also noticing that there's been a spike in overdoses in teenagers that are 17, 18, 19 years old in their early 20s and on college campuses, because they're taking these pills, these pharmaceutical pills that are being made in form now, and those are made with fentanyl. And people are literally taking one pill to have a good time, and they're dying. And they're 17 and 18 years old.
You told our screener anti-anxiety meds, common meds like Xanax?
Yes.
Laced with fentanyl. Are you seeing that, Ceci? Any idea about that?
Yep. So the issue of pressed pills is huge. You know, and that includes Xanax and then other pills like Oxy and other presumably pharmaceutical opioid pills. Correct, yeah.
Aliyah, thank you very much for pointing that out. Another thing to be careful about. Andy in Bushwick, you're on WNYC. Thank you for calling in.
Hey, how's it going? I just had to kind of piggyback on this discussion. I am a DJ in the Brooklyn scene, and I know that we deal a lot with GHB as a substance in New York, and I understand that a lot of EMTs are not always trained in how to deal with this. And I'm just kind of adding this to the discussion because it seems like there's a lot of misinformation about what actually is going on it seems like there's a lot of misinformation about, like, what types of substances are actually being used. And I'm curious if you guys could add a little bit to that discussion.
Caroline, anything on that?
I'm not sure, actually, about GHB and, you know, whether that's, like, being laced. I think also, like, there's a lot. I actually would be interested what Ceci has to say, because I think that often things are captured in, like, anecdotal reports and, you know, people just being involved in the scene that wouldn't necessarily be captured in, like, data that I've been looking at.
Ceci, go ahead.
Definitely. Yeah, so GHB is definitely a huge issue specific. I mean, not an issue as in a problem, but I think, you know, like, the health consequences and the consequences when people aren't fully informed about, you know, how to use safely is definitely a big issue, particularly within queer and trans party scenes and culture. And there's no evidence to suggest that GHB or GBL is being laced or tainted with fentanyl, but a lot of it comes down to people simply not being informed about exactly what the drug they're using even is, because there's quite a big difference between GHB versus GBL, which is a precursor drug to GHB. And GBL is far more potent and it crosses the blood-brain barrier much faster, so you feel the effects more quickly and it hits harder and it moves along faster. So, I mean, there's simply that issue. And, you know, we know while there's not a Narcan antidote to GHB overdoses, we know that the kind of structural solution to this is a safe supply, meaning decriminalizing the supply chain and setting up some sort of legal regime such that people are able to access pharmaceutical grade drugs that have mm-hmm. been tested, you know, for mm-hmm. quality. And, you know, there's full information about what consumers are actually getting.
I was going to ask you that at the end of the segment, but I'll ask you now. people who go into marijuana dispensaries in legal states will see pretty precise breakdowns of ingredients that are in different cannabis products. And there are, you know, state regulatory agencies and testing required to control things like that. Do you think, as someone who works in harm reduction, that there would be less harm from opioids or any other potentially dangerous drugs if every what we think of as illegal or street drug right now was treated in the same way?
Absolutely. It's not even a question, and it's not even like a matter of my own personal opinion. You know, we have so much data about this, specifically when it comes to pharmaceutical grade heroin. You know, there are decades of research about heroin assisted treatment. That's in Switzerland, that's in the UK, that's in Canada. And we know that, you know, overdoses go down. And then overall, you know, beyond just saving people and preventing death, you know, we want to make sure people are actually being able to live fulfilling, stable lives. And that's what we see in the data, is that people are actually stabilized when they know what's exactly in their drugs, you know, where they can get it routinely. You know, the price is stable. It's not being interrupted, you know, whenever there's a big drug bust going on. So we know that it improves consumers' lives. And it's a matter of reframing the conversation entirely around bodily self-determination and really empowering people to, you know, make their own decisions and giving them all the resources that they need to be taking care of themselves. And right now, really, the paradigm is not that. And it's very much about the state giving little tools out, you know, basically giving breadcrumbs to the problems that they've created. And I think that's a really important part of all of this, is that the problem isn't fentanyl itself. You know, so 10 years from now, if we still have a criminalized drug supply, it's going to be something different. And the problem really is prohibition itself. And the entire drug war, we've seen, you know, in data through research, that its effect is that it destabilizes the drug supply chain, and it makes the supply completely unpredictable yeah. and ever more potent. And that theory is called the Iron Law of Prohibition. And so there's a lot of research to support that.
We're almost out of time, but I know you have both spoken about the changing demographics of who's using these particular drugs. And Caroline, recent reporting on cocaine laced with fentanyl has focused on the rave culture, mostly concentrated in northern Brooklyn and southern Queens. But you reported in June that 42% of cocaine-involved overdoses in New York City occurred in the Bronx, followed by 25% in Manhattan, whereas only 17% and 14% of these deaths, respectively, happened in Brooklyn and Queens. So what does this data indicate to you in our last minute?
Yeah, I just want to clarify also that that's 42% of the overdose deaths involving cocaine and fentanyl without heroin in 2019 took place in the Bronx. So like literally the exact problem we're talking about is not concentrated in these, like, you know, what's seen as like this, like, you know, wealthy white party culture, you know, even though that's sort of the image that cocaine has as a drug. And I think that it just speaks to like where we need to direct resources and who really is most at risk, you know, from these drugs.
Do you want to add anything to that as a final thought, Ceci?
Definitely. I think just kind of circling back really quickly to my original comment about being wary of this as a trend, what I meant by that was specifically this as a trend among kind of like hipster, professionalized, white kind of wealthier class. We have to be aware of that as a trend because, you know, for decades now, Black and brown communities have been suffering. And it's really so, like, from the data, I think, in, you know, with the concentration in the Bronx, it very much is an issue that's been longstanding. And we have to be careful about thinking about this as a trend based off of claims related to, like, the deaths of two people in a relatively affluent community. We have to be thinking about this long term and actually giving the resources where they're due.
Ceci Kuwabara-Blanchard is a, sorry, I had that in front of me and now it popped out. There it is. Harm reduction outreach worker at a New York City syringe exchange program, program director of the Democratic Socialists of America's Opioid Overdose Prevention Program, and a freelance journalist. And Caroline Lewis is a health reporter who contributes frequently to WNYC and Gothamist. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC, and that is Black Sabbath's Into the Void from their 1971 album, Master of Reality. This summer, we're looking at, or rather listening to, some iconic albums that turned 50 this year and digging into the political and social context in which they were made and their impact on both music and culture. 1971 is seen as a pivotal year in various genres of popular music. We've already discussed Marvin Gaye's album, What's Going On, and Joni Mitchell's album, Blue, in this series. Today's album is Master of Reality by the band Black Sabbath. Our special guest for this is Henry Rollins. You may know him as the former frontman of the hardcore punk group Black Flag. Henry hosts a weekly radio show on NPR member station KCRW in Southern California. Maybe you know him from that. He's also a self-described Black Sabbath advocate. Thanks for doing this, Henry. Welcome to WNYC.
Oh, thanks, Brian.
Before we get into some songs from the album and play some more music clips, for our listeners who actually may not be familiar with Black Sabbath, that's vocalist Ozzy Osbourne, guitarist Tony Iommi, bassist Geezer Butler, and drummer Bill Ward, for the uninitiated, even if they've heard of Ozzy Osbourne, can you talk a bit about who they were before Master of Reality came out?
Well, Master of Reality was their third album. It came out in July of 1971. It was preceded by the Paranoid album, which came out in September of 1970, which gave them a huge hit, the song Paranoid, which made them huge all over the world, especially in America. And before that, in 1969, they put out the album Black Sabbath, which had the song Black Sabbath. These three albums really established them and kind of established a new genre, what eventually became known as heavy metal. So I think by the time Master of Reality came out, and you have to remember that between the first and third albums is a little under a year and a half. So the band is probably being poked by the record company, like, keep making music because it's selling. Mm-hmm. And that often is the ruin of a band. But Black Sabbath was so good, they made three really strong albums. And I think the most together of those three albums would be the third one, Master of Reality, as far as sounds, playing, chops, the way the rhythm section swings, how the quality of the vocals and Ozzy's singing, the songwriting, the compositions, the song Into the Void that you just played, I think is one of Black Sabbath's master strokes. And it's my personal favorite Black Sabbath album and has been for about 40 years or so.
Let's talk about the genre that you just called heavy metal. In a recent interview for Loudwire, the bassist from Black Sabbath, Geezer Butler, put it this way, in terms of a social context for the emergence of that. He said, we'd grown up in the aftermath of World War II, and Aston, where we were from, still had bombed out buildings and neighbors with war wounds. At the time of Master of Reality, Vietnam was raging, the Cold War was at its coldest, the troubles in Northern Ireland were close to home. A few others were singing about the underside of life, but we had the heaviness to hammer the subjects home, unquote. So you want to talk a bit about how the heaviness of the instruments and the lyrics, like we heard in the intro to the song, Into the Void, help convey the experience of the band's generation at that time?
Sure. You have to remember, parts of England at that time, young people were growing up not seeing trees, going years and years of their life never eating real eggs, you know, still on powdered eggs. And as Geezer said, parts of your town are bombed out. Like, you're after school, you're playing in the ruins of what World War II wrought upon your town. The band is from the Birmingham area, which is central England, very, very industrial. And I've read an interview with Tony Iommi at one point where he said, we were just emulating the sounds of our city, which is a lot of the clanging and banging of, like, the guts of a factory. And I think that the Black Sabbath guys were just not inhibited by the cool people in London. They're kind of remote in the center of England, left to their own devices. And I think they just wrote lyrics about what they were seeing around them and what they were feeling. And they weren't trying to necessarily make it on the radio. And I think that ended up being one of their strengths. They weren't trying to please necessarily. And they were just doing what they thought was the right thing to do without concern for radio success. And I've talked a lot with all four members of Black Sabbath, and they make jokes about how they're failures. I'm like, how can you say you're a failure with like 75 million records sold, probably more by now? And they just laugh and go like, no one likes this. I'm like, come on, everyone likes you guys. And so I think they were just kind of telling you what was on their minds. In those days, it's kind of a standout thing to do. In fact, I would go as far as to say it's pretty punk rock.
And in fact, I wonder if we have any Sabbath fans or general metalheads out there. We can take just one or two phone calls in this segment as we continue to talk to Henry Rollins and play some tracks. But listeners, what did Black Sabbath's Master of Reality mean to you at the time, if you were into it at the time in 1971? Do you have a story of when you first heard a song from the album or anything like that? Or if you're younger, how were you introduced to the album and what has it meant to you in your personal life or political or social context of more recent times in 1971? 646-435-7280, 646-435-7280, or tweet your thought at Brian Lehrer. And in this series, Henry, we've talked a lot about how the Vietnam War figures into the iconic albums of that year, but we haven't really gotten into what we could consider the even broader context, which was the Cold War. And that bird's eye view is something that really comes up in this record again and again in the lyrics. Here's a bit of the song, Children of the Grave. Right, and if those lyrics were a little hard to hear, must the world live in the shadow of atomic fear? Can they win the fight for peace, or will they disappear? Now, the UK was not essentially a part of the Vietnam War as we think of the US, but you want to talk about how the themes of mutually assured destruction, as they refer to there in that line about atomic fear, come up in this album?
If you think about the Vietnam War, as horrible as it was very localized to Vietnam, parts of Cambodia and Laos. And so if you're in England, you're not getting any on you, if you will. But nuclear destruction, you know, if there's wind, you're gonna suffer. And so that brings in all of humankind. And I think that's a bit what they were getting at with Children of the Grave. There's a line in there towards the end of the song, all you children of today are children of the grave. And I think that's Geezer Butler wrote the lyric. He was the primary songwriter, lyric writer for Black Sabbath, and a really great lyricist too. And I think he was trying to say, we're all in this together because of the nature of what a nuclear bomb can do. And the Cold War, as far as your danger level, it could be everybody's war. And you remember from 1962, October, the Cuban Missile Crisis, we find out later, decades later, McNamara, Secretary of Defense McNamara, met with his Russian counterpart as two old wise men. And we find out that the Russians were much closer to pressing the button. Like we were, it was much worse than our worst nightmares. It was apparently very, very close to go, which we might not be having this conversation right now. Mm. And I think, I remember being a young person listening to Master of Reality, and it was the idea of nuclear destruction and environmental damage that struck me as being really amazing about Black Sabbath, like what they're getting at lyrically. Because, you know, they got every bad review known, like, they, you know, they're dumb, they're thugs, they can't play.
Right. Bang,
but if
bang,
you listen
bang.
Carefully to the records, the rhythm section swings, the guitar player is amazing, and Ozzy's an iconic singer. And the lyrics are anything but stupid.
We have some interesting-looking calls coming in. Let's take a couple. Catherine in Manhattan, who remembers being 14 in 1971. Hi, Catherine. What's your Black Sabbath story?
Hi there. Well, I grew up in Holland, Michigan, and which is a very conservative area. But for some reason, at that time, the 1970s, there were many people who were very knowledgeable about music and art, etc. So my best friend and I were taken to a concert in Grand Rapids, Michigan, by my friend's older brother. And there was such an outpouring of young people. I mean, everybody was so excited to attend this concert because in my area, there wasn't a lot of, there weren't a lot of bands that came through. Frank Zappa came, that was fabulous. But then Black Sabbath was another experience. So in the vestibule, as we were getting into the space, it was just packed with young people. And it was so packed. It was one of those experiences where people were getting lifted off the ground and everyone was trying to, you know, push in. And there was condensation on the windows and people were writing, I can't breathe. And it was very impactful, this whole experience. But finally, everybody got in and the band was so unbelievable. It just, you know, it was a small space and there's so much sound. I think that it was a coming of age for many of us who lived in that area.
Catherine, thank you so much for that story. We're going to go right to Taylor in Elmhurst. You're on WNYC. Hi, Taylor.
Oh, hi. Good morning. Thank you for having me. I grew up in El Salvador in the 1970s, and Black Sabbath, my brother introduced me to Black Sabbath. And that was in the middle of the war that we were having. That was our sanctuary. That was the music that we were the outcasts. When we were young and poor, you were either in the military or you were either in the guerrillas. There was nothing in between, but there was in between. It was us, the outcasts, the poor people that had nothing left to live for. And so Black Sabbath and all those lyrics, and Children of the Grave was so like personal. It's so normal at the time to see dead bodies on the sidewalk, and you would wonder, is it really that true? So that music was just, personally to me, it was a sanctuary. It was this fascinating.
This is an amazing story, and don't go away yet, Taylor. Henry Rollins, is this a surprise to you that people were listening to Black Sabbath in El Salvador in 1971?
That doesn't surprise me at all. I think Black Sabbath is one of those rare bands that anywhere there's electricity, there's going to be fans because they speak to real people. So that doesn't surprise me at all.
What about? Go ahead, Taylor. Yeah, you go.
If I may add the following, we were that poor. If visualize one of those parties of, let's say, the Bee Gees, you know, one of those pop musics. And you'll have the preppy boys going in, dancing with the girls. And we were the outcasts. We couldn't even have money to go in and buy a soda pop. So we were the ones outside just wondering, can we ever go in? But that music sucked. And then when it came to Black Sabbath, that was us. And so even Grandma used to tell me that we were listening to devil worshiping. It had nothing to do with it. It had to do with us. It was something that connected us that we understood. And mind this, at the time, I think if you were listening to, you know, bands like Sabbath and Deep Purple and Led Zepp, you were thought to be, a pothead, you know, uh-huh. which didn't make sense. We were just enjoying it. There was no, right, you know.
And Taylor, so, thank you so much for your call. Thank you. You know, I'm going to play another track excerpt coming out of one thing that he mentioned, because Black Sabbath has been associated with Satanism since the beginning. That's because the year before Master of Reality came out, Black Sabbath's first self-titled LP, meaning just called Black Sabbath, featured an upside-down cross in the gatefold sleeve. But there's one song on the album that might seem a bit out of character if Satanism was what listeners were expecting. Let's take a listen to a little bit of After Forever. All right. And could it be you're afraid of what your friends might say if they knew you believe in God above? They should realize before they criticize that God is the only way to love. So that's on Master of Reality. Surprising for Sabbath fans, or where does the whole supposed Satanism thing come in?
Well, if you ever hung out with the Black Sabbath guys, I don't think you'd be thinking that there's any Satan going on. I think that was just something they wrote a song about. I don't think there's any rituals or any of that. Geezer Butler wrote that lyric, and I think Geezer was raised religiously, so I think that kind of pertains to perhaps his upbringing. But I never bought into Black Sabbath being anything more than a rock band. And also, those guys were really young when they wrote those songs. I think you can, as a young person, you can say all kinds of things and not necessarily be able to intellectually back them up or have to be all that responsible. It's not like anyone's going to lose everything because of someone mentioned Satan in a song.
We've just got a few minutes left. Question about you and your relationship to this, because if I understand my music history, exactly 40 years ago this month, you quit your day job as head manager of a Häagen-Dazs ice cream shop in D.C. to join the band Black Flag, which is widely considered to be one of the first hardcore punk bands. What kind of line can we draw from Black Sabbath's Master of Reality 50 years ago to punk rock and the genres that came later in the 70s and, you know, 40 years ago when you joined Black Flag? What's the legacy of the album in that lineage 50 years on?
Well, your last caller said, you know, he's too broke to get into the dance hall, so he's outside with his friends. And Black Sabbath was their band, the outsiders' band. You're not the quarterback. You're not going to meet the cheerleader. Black Sabbath is your band. You know, look at the four members of the band, four rough-looking guys from a tough part of England. They don't look like rock stars. They look like, you know, guys who punch your lights out outside of a bar. And there's outsider people anywhere you look, and that just describes many punk rockers. Also, people who are politically aware or ecologically aware or aware of corruption in government. And Black Sabbath goes after all of that. And Black Sabbath is afraid to say not everything's going okay. Like, their love songs are like, they're about loss. And I think a lot of people would prefer the clearer lens of real life rather than the sugar water of pop music, which I don't mind all the time. Yeah. But a good dose of Sabbath is a good thing. And I think there's a lot of parallels between the music of Black Sabbath and a lot of punk rock bands, the outsider nature, the aim at truth, and not being accepted necessarily by the mainstream and not really being concerned.
We're going to go out on one last song from the album called Lord of This World, and it really ties together the heavy sound and disaffected lyrics that we've been talking about. So we want to thank Henry Rollins, self-described Black Sabbath advocate, formerly the lead vocalist of the band Black Flag, and now host of a weekly radio show on NPR member station KCRW. Henry, thanks so much for coming on. This was really fun.
Thank you. Have a great weekend.
You're searching for
thanks for listening to Brian Lehrer Weekend. We're back on the radio Monday morning at 10 a.m. In the meantime, follow us on Twitter at Brian Lehrer or facebook.com/Brian Lehrer WNYC, where there's always a conversation 24/7.